any company that needs guidance to set goals and drive them could benefit from me or another fractional CFO. Most companies don't need a full-time CFO for a very long time. You can get by with a few hours from an expert a week. And I think that's why the space is kind of blowing up, frankly.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company spend without buying an ERP, but we are not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Patrick McCarthy from My Startup Consulting. Patrick is a CFO, one of those poor souls who decides to help fledgling businesses go from not a business to a business. And we're going to have a little bit of fun at his expense of what a terrible target market that is, speaking as someone who has been a startup myself. And we're also going to dig into one of my favorite topics, operationalizing a budget. So the budget and the cash flow forecast that you start off with in your spreadsheet. What's Patrick's approach to actually making that a reality? And he's got some good war stories along the way to sort of illustrate the points as we go here. So Patrick, thanks very much for coming on to the show. Maybe you could kick us off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you, James. I think something that I keep hidden under wraps is that I'm a big metalhead and have been for my whole life and love live music and I'm quick to jump in the mosh pit at all my favorite metal shows.
Very good. Awesome. I love every time I meet a new CFO, they surprise me. But I have to tell me, you got me with this one. I was one of those kids who was too nerdy to be a metalhead. You know, even though metalheads are a little bit nerdy, let's face it. But I was even too nerdy for that. So what's the mosh? Maybe we better tell people. I thought the mosh pit was just an Irish thing, to be honest. I didn't even know it was a thing. So what's the mosh pit? And what have you learned from the mosh pit that you take to your day-to-day as a CFO?
Yeah, I think so. You know, a mosh pit is really just a way to have fun at a metal show and, you know, get your energy out in a way that's, you know, at the same time aggressive, but has lots of rules, shockingly. A lot of people don't know that, you know, mosh pits at shows, especially metal shows, are supposed to have rules. Most bands and most venues are good about enforcing that. And really, the mob itself in the mosh pit is part of enforcing those rules. And I think one thing you can kind of take from that is, you know, even in a chaotic environment, you can create a sense of safety and respect by establishing basic rules for everyone to follow. And so basic examples in the mosh pit are if someone falls down, pick them up, try not to kick or punch aggressively.
So you can kick or punch playfully. Is that the way it works?
Yeah. You know, and, you know, it's the difference between swinging wildly and swinging in front of you in a, you know, controlled way. And so, yeah, I think it's kind of making sense of chaos. And I think that's a lot of what I do day to day, working primarily with early stage venture backed startups, is creating rules and order in a chaotic environment. They're loose rules, and I can't absolutely control chaos. And I think if you try to absolutely control a mosh pit, you'd go insane. And it's kind of the same with trying to absolutely control the day to day of a startup.
And have you seen the mosh pit sort of eject people who weren't? Does everyone realize, okay, this guy's out? And what happens? Does he get thrown over the fence or just pushed out or what?
Yeah, you'll get pushed out essentially. Yeah, I've seen more aggressive instances where someone was a repeat offender and they got punched and kicked out of the mosh pit. But
right. No,
there are folks who enforce those rules. It's because they want to have a good time themselves and they want everyone else in the mosh pit to have a good time.
Awesome. The irony isn't lost on me. It sounds maybe more civilized than some of the startups I've been a part of, actually. So maybe I'll give it. I love this idea. I do remember trying to pretend to be one of those kids, you know, at the front, head banging at the front, but like I had short hair, it wasn't working. Okay. Awesome. So listen, you don't get to be on the Gross Profit Podcast without being pretty awesome, especially as a fractional CFO. So tell us a bit about how you started in this career and how it's going now, where you are today, how you came to be where you are helping startups as a fractional.
Sure. Yeah. I started my career like most finance people in New York and investment banking. I did about a year of mergers and acquisitions. Hell, learned a ton. You know, is trial by fire. But ultimately didn't see myself staying in that world. And, you know, if you stick with it, there's a pretty clear track to success in investment banking. And if you just do the time and do the timeline, you know, you'll be a very wealthy and happy person. Oh, I don't know about happy, but you'll be a very wealthy person. I didn't see myself going down that track. I had the serendipity of meeting Will Mayo, who's the founder of Spoken Layer, while I was in that job. And I had interned with him previously at an accelerator as an accelerator intern while I was in college. And he had just raised some money and he needed some support of kind of a generalist nature, someone who could do numbers, but also kind of be in a chief of staff role. So I said, yes, get me out of here. And that started my startup journey. So I spent 5 years with Will. We raised around $10 million for Spoken Layer in that time. We got the business to profitability and lots of revenue. I think at least over 5 million, probably pushing close to 10 by the time I left. And so, you know, built a team, grew the company, and my role evolved a lot while I was there. It was really a chief of staff role in the beginning, literally helping Will write hundreds of emails to investors and potential partners and, you know, growing the business, writing code even,
wow,
all the way up through eventually becoming, you know, solidifying into a finance role, finance and ops role. So I got most of the startup training I needed through that experience. We had, you know, big ups and downs through that time that we can talk about more. But at the end of that 5 years, the company hired a new CEO. I was kind of old guard Spoken Layer and they were doing something new with the company. So I moved on from the business on great terms with everyone in the board. And that's when I started my fractional CFO business, which I've been now doing for 5 years. I think really all I do is apply all the skills I learned in managing chaos from both Spoken Layer and the Mosh Pit to early stage companies.
Okay, well, I'll ask you a bit about some of your successes here. But just before I get onto that, I want to, just for my own curiosity, like the M&A world, I'll be honest, and this isn't a particularly cool thing to say, but when I deal with M&A people, I feel like I'm not entirely safe. And, I don't know if I wouldn't say that. I tell you what kind of gets me about it, and maybe you can tell where I'm wrong. I feel like there's a certain amount of like information asymmetry is power in that world. And therefore, you know, I'm a kind of hippy dippy programmer, Bay Area wannabe, right? Where it's all, everything's open and we're transparent and so on. But that world seems to be the antithesis of that. And yet they have to kind of collide sometimes. And it just feels the culture fit is harsh. Am I wrong? Am I paranoid?
Oh, I think it all comes down to incentive structures, right? Someone who's sitting in an M&A seat is only looking at mergers and acquisitions transactions as an outcome for the company. So they're not incentivized to do what might be best for the company. That's not to say a merger and acquisition might be what's best for the company, but that's the only incentive that they get, right? They don't have an incentive to even structure a fundraising round for you, right? That's more of that's kind of a different role, a different part of their company probably. And someone else gets the money and the glory there, even if that's probably the right move for you. So I think there is, you know, something to say about incentive structures and, you know, hammer sees a nail. And that's,
well, and what was the thing that made you want to move on from it? Was it that or something else? Or, I mean, just be open here. Was it straight up, it wasn't, you know, you weren't succeeding at it? Or was it just the way you had to succeed, you weren't comfortable with, or what?
No, it wasn't any of that. It would have been fine. I could have done it. I could have gone down that path and, you know, probably be sitting in a VP seat or partner seat even at this point, depending on the firm. But I think the allure of the startup opportunity, the bust or bang allure, because I did get equity in Spoken Layer as part of my comp package. And, you know, I believe at that time that it was going to be a massive company. Okay. So, you know, I think that, and I would, you know, I would even go so far as to encourage people to look at those types of experiences more closely early in their career, because it gives you an opportunity to learn more and grow more than anywhere else. It's nice though, and you have to have the right personality type for it, because for some
what is
people,
that what is that personality type, like what's it, is it alpha male?
No. I think part of it is a huge part of it is learning stress management techniques and just being able to manage your stress effectively. I was not good at that when I started it, and now I'm exceptionally good at stress management. And so if you can't manage your stress, if everything bothers you and you can't get things out of your head, don't go into startups. if you want a structured path for your life, a structured path for your growth, don't go into startups. You have to be able to kind of accept the serendipity and chaos of it all and let it guide you and flow with it, be like water. Otherwise, you'll get swallowed up.
Okay, cool. Well, we're going to get into your experience, you know, with that first startup a little bit more. But before we do, you have had at least one pretty big win so far with a client that you helped to exit. I want to hear a bit about that. We'll get into some of the lows in a second, but let's concentrate on the highs. Tell us a bit about the work you were able to do with Paperspace.
Yeah. I think I came in through a referral, like most of my business, from an investment I had made, actually, and heard that Paperspace needed some CFO support. They had just kind of restructured how they were approaching their revenue and business model and had just expanded their revenue team pretty aggressively and needed financial operations and CFO support. So most of my time early on there was focused on kind of getting that revenue machine humming. And it was quite challenging. There's a lot of moving pieces. They were changing how they were doing things. And so there's always challenges and fits and spurts there. But we were humming along. And then the company kind of needed to make a decision to either raise more capital or look at acquisitions. And as they were on the fundraising path, they got an offer that they really couldn't look away from. And we started on a 9-month acquisition journey. Honestly, the process for $100 million deal, the process was fairly tight. I think both parties were really incentivized to get the deal done and moved. And there was a lot of good relationships between the two teams because they worked in the same space and they'd all spoken and kind of knew each other and knew what each other team was working on. So there was a lot in our favor, but you know, it was still a grueling 9-month acquisition process. Brought me back to the very beginning of my career. And it's essentially me as a fractional CFO, I was only in the business 10 hours a week, sitting across from a full PwC finance M&A team evaluating the deal, get them everything they needed to make the decision. So super challenging, but extremely rewarding experience. I mean, everyone walked away feeling pretty good about that deal. And yeah.
Very good. So I'll guess just for the listener here, I'll fill in a little bit. So Paperspace is GPU basically hosting, which I guess today is a Bonanza's business. So insane. And they were acquired by DigitalOcean. When did that go through?
Would have been November, December 2023.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. And I think publicly reported was $111 million in cash. So quite a big deal for a startup.
Okay. That's interesting. You said something I didn't realize. So it's a $100 million deal, but $11 million in cash. What does that mean? I mean, I thought $100 million meant, was it all stock, the rest of it, or how does it?
No, it was $111 million in cash. Sorry.
I got it. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Insane. Okay. Good day at the office then for a part-time CFO to be able to help pull that off. Okay. Congratulations. Okay. So you can definitely, for those startup listeners out there, this guy can get you to $100 million if you're able to get the offer. But maybe we'll just talk about your experience with Will. You touched on it a little bit earlier on, but you really got hands-on with that business, I guess. And you mentioned you helped him with the fundraising piece of it. So how much revenue did they have when you came on board? And what was your input? Was that your main goal there to fundraise? Was it one of these businesses where you're basically just raising all the time and that's the main thing to do?
Yeah. So I can tell you a little bit about the business too. So correct. Will is dyslexic. He's been dyslexic his whole life. He struggles with any kind of reading. And so after getting through 2 master's degrees, I think, in engineering, had this vision to kind of turn the internet into voice, right?
Yeah.
Turn everything on the internet into voice. Then it comes from his experience learning through audiobooks, learning through all different types of methodologies that don't involve just pure text. And so his first kind of touch at that was went to TechCrunch Disrupt with a B2C podcasting app that was going to turn articles on the internet into voice. And had a big launch at TechCrunch Disrupt, and then found out B2C is really hard to do without a lot of money. And, you know, this was 2011, I think his TechCrunch Disrupt launch was.
All right.
It was pretty early for podcasting. in general in the voice space. So he was pretty ahead of the curve on that. And I would argue, I'll argue throughout this that we spent our whole life at the company too far ahead of the curve on podcasting.
Well, being early is the same as being wrong, right? That's the saying. So yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And we were pretty early. And so while I interned with him at the Accelerator, which was my junior year of college, he was in the middle of a pivot from B2C to B2B, basically pivoting the company to provide a service to a software as a service to large content producers, primarily news organizations, to get them podcasts out of their existing content. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where I rejoined a year and a half later, was that pivot was quote unquote complete. The product was ready, and we needed to kind of scale it to news organizations. And so I'd say the first 2 years with Will was really honing what the product was for that B2B market, both from a sales and finance perspective, like what are they paying for? How are they paying for it? What does it look like when they actually get it? Because, you know, you can go to every organization does things differently, right? And we didn't have the foresight to be like, oh, we should just take from RSS feeds and they can just send us an RSS feed and we can process it straight from there. It was like all of that was a learning process. Every part of the building the product was a learning process through conversation with news organizations, mm-hmm. primarily.
So to be clear, they would take the RSS feed, which is like text, a notification basically of a file, and of which we give you an MP3 file, I guess. And then what would it do with it? Would it turn it into text or annotated, or what did it do?
So yeah, we get a raw text article from, say, Time was a big customer of ours. So Time would send us an RSS feed of articles that they wanted produced into audio. And the one thing Will had done early is build a network of voice actors to read the articles. And so he had a pretty clever system for the B2C side already built, where the RSS feed dumped the text in, someone read it with a just straight out whatever came in the RSS feed they read, which we also found out later was not a good podcast, did not make for a good podcast. And so that was already built. And that was the basic form of the product. Now, I'll jump ahead just to kind of show the listeners how you learn, what that learning and growth looks like. Eventually, that evolved into a full scripting pipeline process that we could run and produce an article in, I think, under 2 or 3 minutes, depending on the length of the article, but with full production, custom audio at the top and bottom of the podcast. We ran production mode on it to, you know, cut out highs and lows and, you know, kind of keep the audio clear, and re-scripted the articles to be better for a reading format, a spoken format.
Got it.
And so it really evolved from just like someone literally just reading text that they got to podcasts, like actual short form podcasts. So that was the evolution over those 5 years of the product. My focus was both helping to translate what customers were saying to us to that with the tech team. And that's actually where Will spent most of his time. And then also financing all of that and getting companies, you know, enterprise sized companies to pay us for that.
Okay, interesting. So you mixed finance, which is paying the hungry entrepreneurs or engineers, rather, ramen noodles, I'm guessing. But then you said, oh, I'm also doing the sales role of getting sales. Suddenly said like, hey, I'm getting enterprise sales in. So that's quite a mixture. What were you doing? Were you doing cold outreach? Were you using your network? Were you cold calling?
Will had a pretty great network. He was an excellent networker. He is an excellent networker. And part of it comes from, he's definitely a tech visionary type where he can lay out the vision for something. And, you know, audio, you know, turning the whole internet into a podcast was a pretty big vision. And it still is. And I think, you know, Spoken Layer is still running today and I'm still chasing that mission.
Yeah, I might have a job for him. I mean, we could use this. We have a newsletter, which maybe is a good time for me to promo in the middle of the podcast. I don't normally do, but like we have every week, we put in like 3 news articles from financial mishaps, you might call them. People like Naomi Campbell have been in our newsletter because she didn't put in the right financial controls for the charity she was running. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I want to turn this into like Instagram ads, you know, like saying, hey, this week X, Y, and Z happened, you know, someone's going to jail, someone's going to have to pay back, whatever, as a promo for the thing. So it sounds like maybe that's what we need. I'll look it up. Back to you, though. So you ended up raising $4 million after 400 conversations, which sounds absolutely heartbreaking. How did it come about? Why did it take 400 conversations? And yeah, how did the fundraising come in the end?
That was the grind for our Series A. So the problem was that our metrics were not telling the story that we needed them to, for the amount of, you know, we had a pretty big misalignment between, let me speak plainly, we did not have enough revenue to attract the money we needed to keep the company alive. And so, you know, back in that time when we were raising for a Series A, for a SaaS company, you wanted $1 million in ARR. And we were on our way there, but not quite there. And we were growing a little too slowly for most VCs. So that made the fundraising process brutal. We, you know, cutting back, you know, first thing I would say to someone today, and as a fractional CFO who's been fundraising for more than a few months, is, okay, what are the alternatives? Can we cut back on expenses, extend the runway, get the metrics better, and then go back to market? That wasn't really an option because of the amount of tech we were building. We couldn't really pare back the team. We probably could have a little bit. I've learned a lot since then and probably could have found some areas and been a little more aggressive, but we felt like we couldn't at that time. So we went on a very long fundraising journey. It was ultimately successful. And, you know, the terms we got were a little better than we should have gotten because it was a strategic investor from the radio space. So they were investing not just for financial reasons, but they had other reasons to invest. So ultimately, we didn't even raise that round from VC. That round came from a strategic investor after 400 conversations.
And you say a bit better than you should have. I mean, is that a negative? Was the valuation too high? Or, you know, why was it a negative? I mean, more money sounds good to me.
Yeah, I think most folks would think that. But you have to realize that the valuation you set today, if you're on a venture track, you need to exceed that valuation in your next fundraise, right? Now, if our metrics weren't, like I said, where they needed to be for traditional Series A, and we raised on somewhat traditional Series A terms, it means we were starting from behind for our next round.
Yeah. Okay. So you don't want that down round. It's just, it's a bad place to be. No one wants to invest in a down round. Okay. So it sounds like you learned about financial control. And it's interesting to say, hear you say that you might do things differently a little bit today. So switching on to the topic of financial discipline in startups, it's hard because oftentimes it's people's friends and family on the cap table sometimes, and in the whatever, in the boardroom, or in just even working alongside people. And it's all headcount largely. So when you look around at cutting costs or maybe doing a cash flow forecast and then implementing that, what would you do? What have you learned from that you do maybe slightly differently in mid-2025 versus back then? And what have you learned?
Yeah, I think it would have been to our benefit to cut harder and faster, because I think what I've seen over the years is the death by a thousand cuts really just demoralize and devastate companies because they hesitate to do it all up front. You know, if you're having the conversation about cuts and you're putting everything on the board and looking at what you need and what you don't need, right? If you start timing out the things you don't need, like, okay, we'll do that in 1 month. And if it's still bad, we'll do it in 3 months and we'll cut this one in 5 months. You've gone awry. If it's on the do not need side, you should probably cut it out. And it's extremely difficult because you're playing with people's livelihoods, these people you talk to and work with every day. And I do not take that lightly ever. And I don't think anyone should, but you're also doing them a disservice by letting them hang on a thread, not being certain about their position in the company. It seems like they shouldn't be here anymore. They're not hitting their metrics, and you know, they know you're going to cut them. You know, you're going to cut them. You know, that can be worse sometimes than just letting someone go and letting them move on with their career. And cutting correctly too is important. I think what that means to me is actually giving them support, to find their next role, good references, and even helping to land them in roles. Will did a great job of that when we had to let people go. He opened up his network, actually. Like, people say they're going to do that, and then, you know, you reach out to them and say, hey, can you intro me to X, X, and X? And you're like, well, it's kind of awkward because I let you go. I don't want to do that. So either actually genuinely offer that and do it or don't. But there are things you can do to make cuts, you know, easier on the people you let go. And like you said, ultimately, most expenses come down to people in most businesses.
Yeah, I mean, I have some personal experience here. In the last year, you know, we had a flat year last year. So we went from 25 people down to 9 pretty quickly. And it was like, we did that. We made this mistake. We did our first, you know, set of cuts, which were pretty deep. And then there were 2 people left who went another 3 months later. And of course, they were the difficult ones, like, A, because, you know, it seemed a little bit unfair. Hold on, it was all this big. Once it's a large group, it's almost easier. You know, once you're like picking people off, ones and twosies, it's like much more personal. Whereas you can see it's a systematic need, then I think it's psychologically easier for everyone. Like, it, no, you're right, it's never nice to do, but it's actually, there's a benefit in saying, okay, listen, this is clearly not about you. This is a systematic change. And then we, you know, worked on our cash flow forecast. It's why it's a very psychologically important tool, if you like, because you can just clearly see what's going to happen if you don't. Sometimes you're okay, you're in that, and we were kind of okay, in fairness, you know, we were muddling a little bit, you know, but actually if you pushed it forward a year, 18 months, 2 years, you saw what's going to happen, you realize, oh no, we're not okay at all, it's just gonna, we're getting boiled so slowly like a frog. So this is why I think a great CFO is super important here, because they bring that sort of objectivity, but also an ability to communicate it with compassion. You know, that's the great thing. Like, and it's kind of horrible. I feel bad about the CFO, because this is one of the important functions, is to be the one to say, listen, this is the impact of the decision you're making here, you know, whether you like it or not, I can't do anything about it. This is just what it is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's an extremely difficult thing. I think especially here in the US, your job is connected to healthcare. That really is a huge impact to people. And so, you know, I think the best way I support founders is giving them that view, that objective view of, you know, it's these people now or the business in 12 months, right? Which is always a hard decision to make. So yeah, it's important to not take that process lightly.
Okay, let's switch into a slightly more upbeat topic. It's just the end of the quarter here. You've got familiarity with EOS. You've got a couple of clients who work with an entrepreneurial operating system. Yep. We are doing our rocks right now. We're 2 weeks into the quarter. We're the third week in. We're too late, really. We really struggle with rocks because we either all just fly straight into the wall. No one achieves anything. Or you have couple of people who have like these total gimmies. Everyone knows they're gimmies. And it's like, well, why bother? You know, like that was too, like, and getting the process of like coming up with good rocks is really hard. I'm doing it right now, asking for a friend though. How do you help your team come up with decent rocks? And what role does the finance team have in that process, if at all?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go back to the mosh pit for a second and that theme of mutual respect. Part of mutual respect with your team is being honest and open, right? And I think that's part of the entrepreneurial operating system as well. Sandbag goals are fine, but they don't really help anybody. I think what's most important is the alignment that you can create in EOS. An EOS implementation, like every tool, can either be used effectively or ineffectively. Right. Mm-hmm. I think if folks don't align all of the company rocks up to company goals, like you're supposed to, all the individual leadership rocks up to the company rocks, if that's not properly aligned, you're kind of wasting your time. And so that's the ultimate question is, does every rock that I have move forward the company rocks or not? And if they don't, they shouldn't be rocks, is my perspective. And so from a finance perspective, you really just need to give the team the financial metrics that back the company rocks, right? And so for a lot of my companies right now, it's profitability, right? We want to hit profitability. What does that actually look like from an operational perspective? well, you know, there's really two areas you can look at, three areas you can look at. It's either revenue, cost of goods sold, or OPEX, right? Yeah. So answer on revenue is easy. Here's the targets, sales and marketing, align your goals to those targets. Should be pretty straightforward. On cost of goods sold, less clear. You know, how do we deliver our product more effectively with less overhead, less cost of goods? That could be, you know, as easy as switching from a cloud server you have credits with, you don't have credits with, to one you do have credits with, or it could be incredibly complex and difficult with, you know, a consulting firm, let's say, where you're, oh, my dog just came in. Sorry, that's why the door opened mysteriously.
Awesome.
So, you know, giving
so let me ask about that. So sounds like you come up with a menu of rocks people can pick up. So your role, is that true to say? Or do you take a rock personally yourself as part of that, even though you're fractional, or how does it work?
Yeah, so I'll start with the first part of that question is I collaborate with leadership to set the company rocks from the ones that touch finance. So typically that's revenue, profitability, expenses. And then I do, though, typically those rocks sit under me in their EOS system, but there are, you know, sales and marketing have their rocks that tie up to my revenue goal, right? And so it makes it a collaboration, right? And also gives me the positioning to say, hey, doesn't look like we're on track to this. How do we change this, right? I think that's part of why I like EOS is it just keeps it open and opens line of communications versus people squirreling away from goals or not having clear goals, which is even worse.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. All right, cool. Sounds like it's your useful guy to have to hold a mirror up to that, I guess. And it's a toughie. So before we round out here, I wanted to ask about your perfect customer to work with. You mentioned that you like to work with startups, but within that, how should people self-identify, say, hey, I should really talk to Patrick?
Yeah, so I think my bread and butter has always been B2B SaaS companies that are venture-backed. You know, that's the bulk of my experience in Spoken Layer. And even the clients that I've gravitated towards and held on to as a fractional CFO have mostly been in that space. But ultimately, I think any company that needs that guidance to set goals and drive to them could benefit from me or another fractional CFO. And I would highly recommend it. You know, most companies don't need a full-time CFO for a very long time these days. You can get by with a few hours from an expert a week. And I think that's why the space is kind of blowing up, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot out there, obviously, and it can be hard to sort of figure out. I feel like that when you're figuring someone to work with, basically it's a personality fit, like who, maybe you also have an affinity for heavy metal mosh pits, right? Or maybe it's, you know, it's the vibe, you know, like the vibe is way more important than the technicality. A lot of people can open up Excel and a lot of people can do a lot of, you know, a lot of the fingers on keyboard stuff, but who are you going to get along with? Because the co-pilot in your business really is a CFO in a very sort of, for the want of a better word, intimate way, far more than a lot of the other roles. So it's got to be a really good personality fit. I agree with
that. Yeah, I definitely consider myself a partner to my customers and my clients. Not so much. It's always a partnership relationship. Is it okay if we pause for a second?
Yeah, it's fine. Don't worry. We can actually edit this piece. It's fine. Although animals are also welcome on the show. No problem there. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll just wrap it here. So yeah, listen, this has been really interesting. Thanks very much for being on the show. And thank you for listening this far. If you got this far, I don't want you to go away empty handed. So if you're also a fractional CFO, I'm going to invite you to come along to a mastermind we ran once a month. The mastermind is a group for you to meet other fractional CFOs in a peer setting. We put you into a group of three or four, and you get to bring along a business challenge you've been working on, and you get feedback from peers. It could be anywhere in the world. So we've got the people from the States and Europe and Israel and Singapore even. So it's an interesting thing. It's worthwhile spending part of your hour. On top of that, when you come along to the mastermind, We create marketing material based on the discussions and we share that with the members. So we're going to give you stuff that you can then use on your LinkedIn and your own marketing email and newsletter and so on. So we'll give you unique content that you can use to spread the word and find more clients. So if you want to come along for that, go to grossprofitpodcast.com, click on events, sign up for the next mastermind. And that's my special gift reward for you for listening this far. Patrick, this has been a really good one. I've enjoyed chatting today. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, James. Pleasure to be here.